well, 90% Rachel Childs. Then she'd look out the window and fear the world and remember that 90% of herself was still at least 40% more than she liked. By the second afternoon, the thought of going outside came laden with barely suppressed hysteria, swaddled in more manageable everyday dread. What she saw when she pictured the outside world was what she felt when she dared enter it, that it came at her like a storm cloud, encircled her, took bites of her, inserted itself into her body like a straw, and sucked her dry. In return, it gave her nothing. It thwarted all her attempts to engage it in kind, to be rewarded for her attempts to be a part of it. It sucked her up into its swirl, spun her, and then spit her out of its maelstrom before moving on to its next victim. While Brian was in Toronto, she froze in a Dunkin' Donuts on Boylston. For 2 hours, she couldn't move from the small counter that looked out onto the street. While Brian was legging back from Hamburg one morning, she got into a cab on Beacon Street. They'd driven 4 blocks when she realized she'd entrusted a complete stranger with carrying her safely across the city for money. She had him pull over, overtipped him, and got out of the cab. She stood on the sidewalk, and everything was too bright, too sharp. Her hearing was too acute, as if the ear canals had been cored. She could hear 3 people on the far side of Mass Ave talking about their dogs. A woman, 10 feet below on the river path, berated her child in Arabic. A plane landed at Logan, another took off, and she could hear it. Could hear the cars honking on Mass Ave, and cars idling on Beacon, and revving their engines on Starrow Drive. Luckily, there was a trash barrel nearby. She took 4 steps and threw up in it. As she walked back toward the apartment she shared with Brian, the people she passed stared brazenly at her with contempt and disgust and something that she could only identify as appetite. They contemplated nipping her as she passed. A Scientologist accosted her at the next block, shoved a pamphlet in her hand, and asked if she'd like to take a personality test. She sure looked like she could use some good news, ma'am. Might learn things about herself that would... She wasn't ever positive, but suspected she might have thrown up on him. Back at the apartment, she found specks of vomit on her shoes, but when she'd puked into the big barrel, she'd been certain it had been all net. She removed her clothes and took a 20-minute shower. When Brian came home that night, she was still in her robe and almost to the bottom of a bottle of Pinot Grigio. He made his own drink, single malt with a single cube of ice, and sat with her in the window seat overlooking the Charles, and let her talk it out. When she finished, the disgust she'd expected to see in his face, the disgust that surely would have lived in Sebastian's, wasn't there. Instead, she saw only... What was that? Good Lord. Empathy. Is that what it looks like? She thought. He used the tips of his fingers to brush her wet bangs back and kissed her forehead. He poured her more wine. He chuckled.
You really puked on a Scientologist?
It's not funny.
But, babe, it is. It really is.
He clinked his glass off hers and drank. She laughed, but then the laugh died, and she thought of who she'd once been. In the housing projects, in the prowl cars on ride-alongs, in the halls of power, in the streets of Port-au-Prince, and that endless night in the squatters' camp in Laogan, and she couldn't connect that Rachel with this one. I'm so ashamed. She looked at this man who was better than any she'd ever known, certainly kinder, certainly more patient, and the tears came, which only deepened her shame.
Ashamed of what? He said. You are not weak, you hear me?
I can't even walk out the fucking door, she whispered. I can't even get in a fucking cab.
You'll see someone, he said. You'll figure it out. You'll heal. In the meantime, where would you want to go?
His arm swept the apartment.
What's better than here? We've got books, a full fridge, an Xbox.
She dropped her forehead against his chest.
I love you. I love you too. We can even do the wedding here.
She took her head off his chest, looked in his eyes.
He nodded.
They got married in a church. It was a few blocks away. Only their closest friends attended. On her side, Melissa, Eugenie, and Danny Marotta, her cameraman in Haiti. On his side, his business partner Caleb, Caleb's wife Haya, a stunning Japanese immigrant who was still struggling to learn English, and Tom, the bartender from the bar where they'd met. No Jeremy James this time to walk her down the aisle. She hadn't heard from him in 2 years. As for Brian, when she'd asked if he wanted his family there, he shook his head, and a darkness settled on him like an overcoat.
"I do business with them," he said. "I do not love them. I do not share the beautiful things in my life with them."
When he spoke of his family, Brian didn't use contractions. He spoke slowly and precisely. She said, "But they're your family." He shook his head.
"You're my family."
After the wedding, they all went for drinks at the Bristol Lounge. Later, she and Brian walked home through the common and the public garden, and she'd never felt better in her life. As they waited out a light to cross Beacon Street, however, Rachel saw two dead girls standing in the middle of the overpass that led to the Esplanade. The one in the faded red t-shirt and the jean shorts was Esther. The one in the pale yellow dress was Witty. The two girls stepped up onto the overpass guardrail. Traffic streamed off Starrow Drive and flowed below them as they dove headfirst from the rail and vanished before they hit the pavement. She didn't tell Brian. She made it back to the apartment without another hitch, and they drank some champagne. They made love and had some more champagne and lay in bed and watched a harvest moon rise over the city. She saw the two girls fall from the overpass and vanish. She catalogued all the people who had vanished from her life, not just the big ones, but the small, everyday ones, and she experienced a sudden grasp of what she feared most out in the world, that they'd all vanish on her one day, everyone. She'd turn a corner, and the wide avenues would be empty, the cars abandoned. Everyone would have snuck out some galactic back door while she paused to blink, and she would be the only person alive. It was an absurd thought, something a child with a martyr complex would marinate in. Yet it felt elemental to understanding the core of her fears. She looked at her newly minted husband. His blinking lids had grown heavy with sex and champagne and the gravity of the day. She knew in that moment that she'd married him for entirely different reasons than she'd married Sebastian. She'd married Sebastian because, subconsciously, she'd known that if he ever left her, she wouldn't give much of a shit. But she married Brian because, although he left her in small ways, enough that she could trust the imperfection of that model, he'd never leave her in the big ones.
"What are you thinking about?" Brian asked. "You seem sad."
"I'm not," she lied. "I'm happy," she said, because it was also true. It was 18 months before she left the apartment again. Chapter 12. The Necklace. The weekend before he left for London, fast approaching their second wedding anniversary, Brian and Rachel rode the elevator down from the 15th floor and left their building. It was raining. It had done nothing but rain that week, but the rain wasn't heavy, more like a mist she'd barely notice until the wet found her bones, similar to the weather the night they'd met. Brian took her hand and led her up to Mass Ave. He wouldn't tell her where they were going, only that she was ready for it. She could handle it. Rachel had left the condo a dozen times over the last 6 months, but she had done so when the environment was at its most controllable— early mornings and weekday evenings, often in the coldest weather. She went to the supermarket, but, as before, only in the early morning hours of a weekday, and she always stayed in on weekends. But here she was, out and about in Back Bay, late on a Saturday morning. Despite the weather, Mass Ave was crowded, so were the cross streets, Newbury in particular. The masshole fans of Red Sox Nation were out in force, the team trying to squeeze in at least one home game in a week when the rest had been rained out. So Mass Ave was teeming with red or blue t-shirts and red or blue ball caps and the people who wore them, studly young frat boy types in jeans and flip-flops already hitting the bars, middle-aged men and women with competing beer guts, kids darting in and out of the fray along the sidewalks, a quartet of them sword-fighting with toy bats. Cars sat in traffic so long the drivers turned off the engines. Horns beeped and horns bayed, and jaywalkers weaved through it all, one guy shouting, "Tight old town! Tight old town!" every time he slapped a trunk. Beyond the sports fans, obnoxious or otherwise, were the yuppies and buppies and the urban hipsters so recently graduated from Berklee College of Music, or BU, to a daunting lack of prospects. Farther down Newbury would be the trophy wives with their duck lips and their purse dogs, sighing at every slip in customer service before demanding to see someone's manager. It had been so long since Rachel had risked entering a crowd that she'd somehow forgotten how overwhelming it could be.
"Breathe," Brian said. "Just breathe."
"Exhaust fumes?" she said as they crossed Mass Ave.
"Sure. Build character."
It was when they reached the far sidewalk that she realized what he had in mind. He turned them toward the Heinz Convention Center subway stop.
"Whoa."
She clamped her free hand over his wrist. He turned with the tug, looked into her face, smiled.
"You can do this."
"No, I cannot."
"You can," he said softly. "Look at me, honey, look at me."
She looked into his eyes. There was a part of Brian that could inspire or grate, depending on her mood, a can-do attitude that bordered on evangelical. He preferred music and movies and books that, in one way or another, reaffirmed the status quo, or at least the idea that good things come to good people. But he was no naive, either. He held enough empathy and wisdom in those blue eyes for a man twice his age. Brian saw the bad in the world. He just chose to believe he could dodge it through force of will. "You win," he'd said more times than she could count, "by refusing to lose." To which she'd replied more than once, "You lose by refusing to lose, too." But she needed that part of him now, that mix of Vince Lombardi and self-help guru, that relentlessly upbeat, sometimes just relentless attitude that her cynical self would have deemed far too predictably American were her husband not Canadian. She needed Brian to out-Brian himself now, and he did. He held up their entwined hands.
"I will not let go."
"Shit." She heard the suppressed hysteria in her voice even as she smiled, even as she knew she was going to do it.
"I will not," he repeated, "let go."
And the next thing she knew, she was on the escalator. No modern wide escalator, this. The escalator at Heinz was narrow, black, and steep, definitely not up to current code. She feared that if she leaned forward for any reason, she'd bring herself, Brian, and everyone in front of them tumbling to the bottom. She kept her chin and head up, spine straight as they descended. The lights dimmed until the descent felt like part of some primitive ritual, one of fertility, perhaps, or birth. Behind her were strangers. In front of her were strangers, faces and motives shrouded in the dim light, hearts beating like the tick of a bomb.
"How you doing?"
Brian asked. She squeezed his hand.
"Hanging in there."
A single drop of sweat left her hair by the temple and slid behind her left ear. It found the back of her neck and rode the line of it into her blouse, where it dissolved against her spine. She'd last suffered a panic attack on the same elevator she and Brian had taken down from their condo this morning. That had been 7 months ago. No, 8, she realized with some pride. 8, she thought, and squeezed her husband's hand again. They reached the platform. The crowd wasn't too thick once it cleared the narrow escalator. She and Brian walked a quarter way down the inbound side of the platform, and she was surprised to discover her hands were dry. Through most of her 20s and early 30s, she'd traveled extensively, descending into a dark tunnel with hordes of strangers to board a tube packed with even more strangers, hadn't even registered on the threat scale back then. Same thing with going to concerts and sporting events and movie theaters. Even in the tent cities and refugee camps of Haiti, she'd had no issues with panic. She'd had plenty of other issues over there, and immediately upon her return, alcohol, OxyContin, and Ativan sprang immediately to mind, but not panic.
"Hey,"
Brian said.
"You with me?"
She chuckled.
I think that's my question for you.
Oh, I'm here, he said. I am right here.
They found a bench built into a wall that sported a map of the MBTA routes, green line, red line, blue line, orange, and silver crisscrossing like veins before branching out on their own. She kept both her hands in his now, and their knees touched. People would look and see an attractive couple, clearly connected. You're always here, she said to him. Except
when I'm not,
he finished for her, and they both chuckled.
When you're not, she agreed. That's just travel, though, babe. You can come with me any time.
She gave that a roll of her eyes. I'm not certain I can get on this train. I'm sure not getting on a plane.
You'll get on this train.
Yeah? Makes you so sure.
Because you're stronger now. And you're safe.
Safe, huh? She looked out at the platform, and then back at his hands, his knees.
Yes, safe.
She looked at him as the train blew into the station hard enough for the air to muss Brian's unruly hair even further.
You ready?
I don't know. They stood.
You are.
You keep saying that. They waited for the exiting passengers and then stepped to the threshold where the car met the platform.
We go on together, he said.
Shit, shit, shit.
Wanna wait for the next one?
The platform was empty. Everyone was on.
We can wait for it, he said.
The doors started to close with a whoosh, and she jumped on, pulling Brian with her. The doors snapped back as they passed between them, but then they were in the car, a pair of old white ladies giving them annoyed looks, a young Hispanic boy with a violin case on his lap giving them a curious one. The car lurched. The train headed into the tunnel.
You did it,
Brian said.
I did it.
She kissed him.
Wow!
The car lurched again, this time as it maneuvered into a turn, the wheels screech-clacking. They were 50 feet underground, traveling 25 miles an hour in a metal can along tracks that were over 100 years old.
I am down here in the deep dark, she thought.
She looked at her husband. He was looking up at one of the ads above the doors, his strong chin tilted up with his gaze.
And I am less afraid than I would have imagined.
They rode the train to Lechmere, the last stop. They walked in the mist into East Cambridge and had lunch at a chain restaurant on the ground floor of the Galleria Mall. She hadn't been in a mall for as long as she hadn't been on the subway, and as they waited for the check, she realized the mall wasn't an accident.
You want me to stroll through this mall? She said.
He was all innocent surprise.
Why, I hadn't thought of that.
Uh-huh. This mall of all malls, it'll be filled with teenagers and noise.
Yep.
He handed the waiter his credit card on the small black tray.
Oh, dear, she said.
He raised his eyebrows.
And if I said the subway was enough daredevil shit for one day, she asked. Then I would respect that.
And he would, she knew. He would. If asked what she loved most about her husband, she might have to say his patience. It appeared, at least when it came to her affliction, bottomless. For the first couple of months after her last attack, the one on the elevator, she took the stairs up to their apartment on the 15th floor. And when he was in town, Brian wouldn't hear of her doing it alone. He'd huff and puff up those stairs with her.
On the bright side, he said once, when they paused to rest between 10 and 11,
their faces sheened with perspiration.
We almost bought that unit on the 22nd floor in that place on Huntington.
He lowered his head, took a deep breath.
I don't know if it would have led to divorce, but we'd definitely be in mediation.
She could still hear the echoes of their laughter in the stairwell, light and weary, threads of it rising toward the roof. He'd taken her hand and led her up the final 5 flights. They'd taken a shower together and then lay on the bed naked and let the ceiling fan dry what the towels hadn't. They didn't make love right away, just lay there holding hands and chuckling at the absurdity of their situation. And that's how Brian looked at it, as a situation, an act of God foisted upon them, so beyond their power to change it that to try would be like trying to change the weather. Unlike Sebastian, as well as some of her friends,
Brian never presumed that the panic attacks were within Rachel's control. She didn't have them because she was weak or self-indulgent or prone to drama. She had them because they afflicted her, like any malady of the body, the flu, a cold, meningitis. When they did make love, it was as the last of the day bled out into the dusk beyond the bedroom window. The river turned purple and then black, and making love with Brian felt, as it sometimes did when they were connecting on every level, like they were drifting over thresholds of bone and slipping through walls of blood, like they were fusing. That day became a standout that she would string together with other standouts, one after the other, for 8 months, until she could look back on the state of her marriage and realize there had been far more superior days than inferior ones. She began to feel safer, sure enough of herself that one day 3 months ago, without warning anyone, Brian, her friends Melissa and Eugenie, her shrink Jane, she took the elevator again. And now here she was in a mall, riding down an escalator into a maelstrom of bodies. Teenagers mostly, as she'd predicted, on a Saturday of all days, and a rainy one, the kind of day mall managers prayed for. She could feel eyes on them, real or imagined, she had no idea, and the press of bodies as they passed, and she could hear so many disparate voices, so many snatches of conversation. "Said you frontin' now, Poot. Pick up, pick up! And, like, I'm expected to just drop everything because he happens? Not if you don't like it, of course not. Olivia has one, and she's not even 11 yet." She was surprised at how calmly she took in all these souls hurtling toward her, past her, and streaming on tiers above and below her with their aggressive need for goods and services, for the itchy satisfactions to be found in acquisition for its own sake, for human connection and disconnection in equal measure. Before she quit counting, she noted 20 couples where one was ignoring the other to talk on a cell phone, for someone, anyone, to tell them why they did it, why they were here, what separated them from insects moving underground right now in colonies that bore a remarkable resemblance to the three-tiered mall in which they found themselves wandering, roving, stalking on a Saturday afternoon. Normally, it was just this type of thinking that preceded a panic attack. It started with a tickle in the center of her chest. The tickle quickly became a piston. Her mouth would turn Saharan. The piston would transform into the sparrow, imprisoned and panicked. It would flap its wings, womp, 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 in the hollowed-out core of her, and sweat would sluice down the sides of her neck and pop on her forehead. Breathing would feel like a luxury with an expiration date. But not today, not even close. Soon she even gave in to the pleasures of a mall, bought herself a couple of blouses, a candle, some overly expensive conditioner. A necklace in the window of a jewelry store caught both their eyes. They didn't even speak about it for the first minute, just exchanged glances. It was two necklaces, actually. A smaller one within a larger, strings of black onyx bead balls, the chains white gold. Not expensive, not even close, probably not even something she'd pass on to a daughter, should she and Brian ever have one. And yet, "What's the pull?" she asked Brian. "What do we like about this?" Brian looked at her for a long time, trying to sort through it himself.
"Maybe because it's a pair?"
He slipped it around her neck in the store, had a little trouble with the clasp. It was too tight, but the salesman assured them that was normal. It would loosen with use, but then the beads draped themselves over her blouse, just below her throat. Outside the jeweler, he ran his palms along hers.
"Dry as a bone," he said.
She nodded, her eyes wide.
"Come on."
He led her to a photo booth under the escalators. He inserted the required coins and pulled her into the booth with him, made her laugh by feeling her breasts up as she was pulling the curtain closed behind them. When the flashbulb flashed within the booth, she pressed her cheek to his, and they made goofy faces, sticking out their tongues or blowing kisses at the lens. When they were done, they looked at the strip of four panels, and the photos were as silly as she'd expected, their heads half out of frame in the first two.
"I want you to sit for another strip," he said. "Just you."
"What?"
"Please,"
he said, suddenly somber.
Okay. I want to mark this day. I want you to look in that lens with pride.
She felt silly in the booth alone, could hear him out there inserting the coins, but she felt a sense of accomplishment, too. He was right on that. A year ago, she couldn't imagine walking out the front door, and now she was in a jam-packed mall.
She stared at the lens. I am still afraid, but I am not terrified, and I am not alone.
When she came out of the booth, he showed her the strip, and she liked what she saw. She looked a little tough, actually, not the kind of woman you'd fuck with.
Every time you see these pictures or you wear that necklace, Brian said, remember how strong you are.
She looked around the mall. This was all you, babe. He took her hand and kissed the knuckles.
I just nudged.
She felt like weeping. She didn't know why at first, but then it hit her. He knew her. He knew her, this man she'd married, this man she'd committed herself to walking through this life with. He knew her. And, wonder of wonders, he was still here.
Chapter 13 Refraction
Monday morning, a few hours after Brian left for the airport, Rachel tried to return to work on the book. She'd been writing it for the better part of a year, but still wasn't even certain what genre it fell into. It had started as straight journalism, an account of her experiences in Haiti, but once she realized it was impossible to write the account without inserting herself into the narrative, the book morphed into something resembling memoir. While she hadn't yet attempted a chapter that detailed her on-camera breakdown, she knew she'd have to give it context once she did, which led to a chapter about her mother, which led to another chapter about the 73 Jameses, which led to an overhaul of the entire first part of the book. At this point, she had no idea where the book was going and no idea how she'd get there even if she did, but most days, she loved writing it. Other days, it fought her to a draw before her second cup of coffee. Today was one of those days. There seemed to be little rhyme or reason as to why one day snatching the correct words from the ether was like opening a faucet, and other days it was like opening a vein, but she began to suspect both the good and the bad parts of the process were connected to the fact that she was writing without a map. No plan at all, really. She fell quite naturally, it seemed, into a more free-flowing approach than she ever would have allowed herself as a journalist, and gave herself over to something she didn't quite understand, something that, at the moment, spoke in cadence more than structure. She wouldn't show the book to Brian, but she did discuss it with him. He was, as always, unfailingly supportive, though she wondered if, once or twice, she caught a patronizing glint in his eyes, as if he didn't quite believe the book was more than a dalliance, a hobby that would never turn into something whole and finite.
"What are you going to call it?"
he asked her one night.
"Transience," she told him.
That's as close as she could get, thus far, to a unifying theme. Her life and the lives of those she'd most memorably encountered seemed marked by a state of never quite taking root, of floating, of spiraling helplessly toward the void. That morning, she wrote a few pages about her days with the Globe, but it felt dry and, worse, rote, so she cashed in early and took a long shower and got dressed for her lunch date with Melissa. She crossed the back bay in the steady rain, the endless rain, the omnipresent rain, biblical rain, Brian had said last night, Noah rain. It wasn't quite that bad, but it had been wet for 8 days now. Lakes and ponds upstate were overflowing into roadways, turning some streets into tributaries. In two cases, cars had been carried off. Over the weekend, a commercial jet had slid off a runway. No injuries reported. Those in a 10-car pileup on 95 hadn't been so lucky. She needn't worry as much as some. She didn't fly, she rarely drove. It had been 2 years since the last time, and she and Brian lived high above street level. Brian flew, though, all the time. Brian drove. She met Melissa at the Oak Room in the Copley Plaza Hotel. The Oak Room wasn't called the Oak Room anymore. Since Rachel's meltdown, it had had a facelift and, after decades as the Oak Room, became Oak, Long Bar, and Kitchen, but Rachel, Melissa, and pretty much everyone they knew still called it the Oak Room. She hadn't been to Copley Square by herself in a couple of years. At the onset of her last prolonged spate of panic attacks, the buildings that surrounded the square, the Old South Church, the Boston Public Library main branch, Trinity Church, the Fairmont, the Westin, and the towering Hancock with its mirrored blue windows reflecting the square back on itself, had one day given her the impression they were leaning in, not buildings anymore so much as walls, great walls built to pen her in. This was doubly unfortunate because she'd always admired Copley for its role as a representative hybrid of old and new Boston. The old, represented by the Beaux-Arts classicism and lustrous limestone of the BPL, and the Fairmont, and of course Trinity Church, with its clay roof and heavy arches, the new, by the icy functionality and hard, sleek lines of the Westin and the Hancock Tower, structures that gave the impression of aggressive indifference to both history and its sob-sister nostalgia. But for almost 2 years, she'd walked around it, not through it. Walking into the square for the first time since her wedding day, Rachel had expected palpitations, accelerant in the blood. Yet as she walked up the burgundy carpet under the Fairmont awning, she felt only the slightest uptick in her heart rate before it reset itself almost immediately to normal. Maybe it was the rain that calmed her. With an umbrella over her head, she was just another near-spectral being in dark clothes, hidden beneath a cowl of plastic, moving through a city of near-spectral beings in dark clothes, hidden beneath cowls of plastic. In this kind of rain and murk, she imagined murders were likelier to go unsolved and affairs unpunished. Melissa said when she mentioned this to her. Thinking of an affair, are we? God, no. I can barely get out of the house. Bullshit. You're here. You took the tea around town this weekend, gallivanted through a mall. She reached out and pinched Rachel's cheek. Such a big girl now, aren't we? Rachel swatted her hand, and Melissa sat back and laughed a hair too loud. Rachel had eaten a large salad and slow-sipped a glass of white wine, but Melissa, on her day off, barely touched her meal and was downing Bellinis as if Prosecco would be outlawed at the stroke of midnight. It made her sharper, funnier, but louder, too, and Rachel knew from past experience how quick the humor could turn into self-loathing, the sharpness could dim, but the loud would just get louder. A couple of times Rachel had noticed other patrons looking their way, though that could have nothing to do with Melissa's volume and everything to do with Rachel. Melissa took a sip of her drink, Rachel noting with some relief that the sips were smaller now. Melissa had been Rachel's producer on dozens of stories at Six, but not, as luck would have it, on any of the Haiti stories. When Rachel suffered her meltdown in Cité Soleil, Melissa was on her honeymoon on Maui. The marriage had lasted less than 2 years, but Melissa still had her job, which she'd always loved far more than Ted. So, as she'd say with a bright, bitter smile and two thumbs up, win-win. So if you were to have an affair with someone in this room, who would it be? Rachel gave the room a quick sweep. No one. Melissa craned her head, staring openly at the room. It is pretty grim pickings. But wait, not even that guy in the corner? Rachel said, with the half fedora and the soul patch. Yeah, he's all right. I don't want to have an affair with all right. I don't want to have an affair at all, but if I did, it would be with the be-all and end-all. And what would he look like? Beats me. I'm not the one looking for a man. Well, it wouldn't be the tall, dark stranger. You're already married to him. Rachel cocked her head at that. Melissa mimicked the gesture. I don't know the guy. She splayed her fingers against her chest. Whenever I talk to your admittedly handsome, admittedly charming, admittedly funny and intelligent groom there, I always get the feeling after he walks away that he said absolutely nothing. I've seen you guys talk for half an hour. And yet, I know nothing about him. He's from British Columbia. I know his bio, Melissa said. I just don't know Brian.
All that charm and eye contact and questions about me and my hopes and dreams is so beautifully packaged, I'm continually surprised to wake up the next day and realize he made sure all I did was talk about myself.
But you like talking about yourself.
I love talking about myself, but that's not the point.
Oh, you have one?
Bitch, I do.
Bitch, spit it out.
They smiled across the table at each other. It was like working together again.
I just wonder if anyone knows Brian.
Me included?
Rachel laughed.
Forget it.
That's your implication.
I said forget it.
And I asked if you're including me in the list of people who don't know my husband.
Melissa shook her head and asked Rachel about the book she was writing.
I'm having trouble giving it shape.
What shape? Melissa asked with a breezy dismissiveness. There was an earthquake in Haiti, then a cholera outbreak, then a hurricane, and you were there for all of it.
When you put it that way, Rachel said, it sounds exactly like disaster porn, which is what I fear most.
Melissa waved that off, which was usually what she did when Rachel ventured into a topic Melissa didn't understand or didn't want to. Times like these, Rachel wondered why she continued to hang out with Melissa. She embraced the shallow the way others searched for the profound, and she could reduce any attempt at complexity to a target of casual scorn. But the last few years had stripped Rachel of almost all her friends, and it scared her to think she'd one day wake up with none at all. So she half-listened to Melissa prattle on about her own work, about the latest round of Who's Fucking Whom at WCJR, both figuratively and literally. Rachel interjected, "Wow," and "No way," and "That's hilarious," where expected, but part of her remained back at the comments Melissa had made about Brian, and her irritation continued to rise. She'd woken this morning in a great mood. All she'd wanted since was to keep that mood alive. She just wanted to stay happy for a day. And not the bullshit, shiny happy of a beauty pageant contestant or a religious fanatic, just the hard-earned happiness of a self-aware human being who'd worked on her fears over the weekend with her loving, if often preoccupied, husband. Tomorrow, she'd allow all the doubts back in. Tomorrow, she'd open herself up to the spiritual termites of minor despair and ennui. But today, on this miserable, soupy day, she wanted to remain not miserable. But it seemed like Melissa was determined to hurl ice water on her glow. When Melissa went to order another round, Rachel begged off with claims of a hair appointment on Newbury Street. She could tell Melissa didn't believe her, but she didn't much care. The rain had softened outside to a light drizzle, and she wanted to walk in it through the public garden to the Charles and then follow the river until she crossed the footbridge to Clarendon and walked back to her building. She wanted to smell the soaked soil and wet asphalt in equal measure. In Back Bay, in this kind of weather, it was easy to imagine Paris or London or Madrid, to feel part of a larger continuum. Melissa stayed behind for one last drink, and they exchanged kisses on the cheek before Rachel left. She turned right and headed down St. James. Walking the length of the hotel, she could see it reflected in the Hancock Tower, could see herself there as well. To the far left of the left pane of glass, part of a mirrored triptych. The left pane was dominated by the sidewalk, and Rachel walking along the edge of it, a short line of cabs to her left just peeking into frame. The middle pane reflected a canted version of the grand old hotel, and the third pane showed the tiny street in between the hotel and the Hancock. It was such a small street that most would assume it was an alley, if they noticed it at all. It was used primarily, if not exclusively, by delivery trucks. A laundry truck was backed up to a pair of double doors at the rear of the hotel. A black Suburban idled at the back of the Hancock, its exhaust mingling with the exhaust of a sewer grate, the rain turning silver as it fell through the smoke. Brian walked out of the Hancock and opened the back door of the SUV. It looked like Brian anyway, but it couldn't be. Brian was in the air, over the middle of the Atlantic by now, legging toward London. But it was Brian. Same jawline, just beginning to widen slightly as he approached 40, same lock of black hair falling over his forehead, Same soft copper trench coat over black pullover that he'd left the house in this morning. She went to call his name, but something in the set of his face stopped her. He wore a look she'd never seen before. It was somehow heartless and hunted at the same time. This couldn't, she told herself, be the same face that watches me sleep at night. He climbed into the SUV, this watery, refracted reflection of her husband. Rachel reached the corner just as the reflected SUV transformed into the actual one. It passed her, its windows black, and turned onto St. James. She pivoted in place, her mouth open but no words leaving it, and watched it cross into the middle lane, pass through the traffic light at Dartmouth, and descend the on-ramp for the Mass Pike. She lost it there to the dark tunnel and the traffic merging behind it. She stood on the sidewalk for a long time. The rain grew heavy again. It pelted her umbrella and rebounded off the sidewalk into her ankles and calves. "Brian," she finally said. She repeated his name, though this time it was no longer a statement, but a question. Chapter 14. Scott Pfeiffer of Grafton, Vermont. She took the direct route back to the condo. She reminded herself that the world was filled with people who looked near identical to others. She didn't even know how precise the resemblance was. She'd seen a reflection that was refracted off mirrored glass in the rain. If she'd had a moment to get a clear view, if he'd paused at the car door and she'd come around the corner in time to look directly at him, she probably would have seen him for the stranger he was. He wouldn't have had the barely perceptible bump halfway up the bridge of his nose, or his lips would have been thinner, his eyes brown, not blue. He wouldn't have had Brian's smattering of pockmarks below the cheekbones, pockmarks so faded you could only see them if you were close enough to kiss them. This stranger might have smiled with hesitation at the woman staring so blatantly at him in the rain, wondered if perhaps there was something wrong with her. Maybe recognition would have dawned on his not-quite-Brian's face, and he'd have thought, "It's that woman from Channel 6 who had the freak-out on air a while back." Or maybe he wouldn't have noticed her at all. He'd simply have gotten into the car and been driven off, which ultimately is what happened. The fact was, Brian did have a double. They'd been talking about him for years, Scott Pfeiffer of Grafton, Vermont. When he was a freshman at Brown, people would tell Brian there was another kid his age, a pizza delivery guy, who looked just like him. It got to the point where Brian had to see for himself. One day, he stood on the sidewalk outside the pizza parlor until he saw his twin step out from behind the counter carrying a stack of pizza boxes in a red leather thermal bag. Brian stepped aside as Scott walked out of the shop and got into a white van with Dom's Pizza stenciled on the door and drove off into Federal Hill to deliver his pies. Brian couldn't explain why, but he never introduced himself to Scott. Instead, by his own admission, he kinda began stalking him. "Kinda," she said when he told her.
I know, but if you could have seen the resemblance, you would have understood how fucking eerie it was. The idea of introducing myself to myself, it was just too weird."
"But he wasn't yourself. He was Scott
Pfeiffer of Grafton, Vermont, yes."
Brian would often refer to him that way, as if somehow the full description made Scott a little less real, a bit more like a character in a comedy sketch. "Scott Pfeiffer of Grafton, Vermont."
"I took a bunch of pictures of him."
"You what?"
"Right," he said. "I told you it was definitely stalking."
"You said it was kinda stalking."
"Used a zoom lens. I used to stand in front of my bathroom mirror in Providence and hold the pictures up beside my face. Full on, left profile, right profile, chin down, chin up, and I swear the only difference was that his forehead was maybe a tenth of an inch taller and he didn't have this bump."
The bump on the bridge of Brian's nose was the result of a fifth-grade hockey injury that relocated some of the cartilage there. It was only visible in profile, never head-on, and even then, one had to be looking for it. Christmas, his sophomore year, Brian followed Scott Pfeiffer home to Grafton, Vermont.
"Your family didn't miss you on Christmas?" she asked.
"Not that I ever heard."
He spoke in that flat tone. Dead tone would be the less charitable description he used whenever he discussed his family. Scott Pfeiffer of Grafton, Vermont, had the kind of life Brian probably never would have coveted if he hadn't seen it up close. Scott was working full-time at Dom's Pizza to put himself through Johnson and Wales, where he was majoring in restaurant management, while Brian majored in international finance at Brown, lived off a trust annuity from his grandparents, and had no idea what his tuition was, only that his parents must have paid it on time because he never heard otherwise. Scott's father, Bob Pfeiffer, was the butcher at the local supermarket, and his mother, Sally, was the town crossing guard. They also served as the treasurer and vice president, respectively, of the Windham County Rotary Club, and once a year they drove 2 hours to Saratoga Springs, New York, and stayed in the same motel where they'd spent their honeymoon.
"How much do you know about these people?" Rachel asked.
"You learn a lot when you stalk someone."
He used to watch the family and pray for a scandal.
"Incest," he admitted, "or for Bob to get caught grabbing some undercover cop's Johnson in the public restroom. I would have taken embezzlement, though I don't know what you'd embezzle from a supermarket meat locker. Steaks, I guess."
"Why would you pray for that?"
"They were too perfect. I mean, they lived in this cute fucking colonial right on the town common. White, of course, picket fence, wraparound porch with, yes, an actual porch swing. They sat out there on Christmas Eve in their sweaters, brought out little space heaters and sat drinking hot chocolates. Told each other stories, laughed. At one point, the daughter, she was like 10, sang a Christmas carol and they all applauded. I'd never seen anything like it."
"Sounds sweet."
"It was hideous. Because if someone can be that happy, that perfect, what's that say about the rest of us?"
"But there are people out there like that," she said.
"Where?" he said. "I never met them. You?"
She opened her mouth and then closed it. Of course she hadn't. But why did she think she had? She'd always thought of herself as a fairly skeptical, if not downright cynical, person. And after Haiti, she would have sworn she'd been stripped of the last vestiges of sentimentality or romanticism, but buried somewhere deep in her brain lay the belief that perfect, happy, and perfectly happy people walked this earth. No such beast, her mother had often reminded her. Happiness, her mother used to say, was an hourglass with a crack in it.
"But you said yourself," she said to Brian, "they were happy."
"They certainly seemed to be."
"But then?"
He smiled, triumphantly, but with a whiff of despair.
"Bob always stopped off at this little Scottish pub on the way home. One day I sat beside him. He gave me this huge double-take, of course, and told me how much I resembled his son. I acted surprised again when the bartender said the same thing. Bob bought me a drink, I bought Bob a drink, and so on. He asked me who I was, so I told him I went to school at Fordham, not Brown, but otherwise I stuck pretty close to the truth. Bob told me he wasn't a big fan of New York City. Too much crime, too many immigrants. By the third drink, immigrants became wetbacks and towelheads. By the fifth drink, he was on about the niggers and the fags. Oh, and the dykes. Hated lesbians, our Bob did. Said if his daughter ever turned into one, he'd, let me see if I get this quote right, superglue her cunt. Turned out Bob had fascinating ideas on corporal punishment that he'd been employing for years, first on Scott and then on Nanette, that was the daughter's name. Once old Bob got talking, he couldn't stop. At one point, I realized that everything that had left his mouth for 15 minutes was repulsive. Bob was a scared, shitless coward of a monster hiding behind his impeccable blandness."
"Whatever happened to Scott?"
Brian shrugged.
"He never went back to school. Probably lack of finances. Last I checked, and this was 15 years ago, he was working at one of the Grafton B&Bs.
"And you never introduced yourself?"
"God, no."
"Why not?"
He shrugged.
"Once I was sure his life was no better than mine, I lost all interest."
So, coincidence of coincidences, Rachel had just come across Scott Pfeiffer of Grafton, Vermont. Maybe he was in town for a food and beverage services conference. Maybe he'd made something of himself, owned a small chain of quality inns across New England. She wished the best for Scott, after all. Even though she'd never met him, he'd become part of the fabric of her memory, and she hoped his life worked out. But how could they both be wearing the same clothes? That was the detail she couldn't dismiss, no matter how hard she tried. Accepting that Brian's double or near double had happened to be in the same city of 2 million was easy enough, she supposed, but to swallow that both men wore a thin copper-colored raincoat over a black cotton pullover with the collar turned up, a white t-shirt, and midnight blue jeans, that required the kind of faith religions were founded on. Wait, she asked herself as she turned up Commonwealth toward her building. How did you see the blue jeans? There was an SUV between you and his legs. The same way she'd seen the rest of him, she realized, reflected in the glass. She'd first seen his face, the coat, and pullover. Then, as the confusion set in, she'd caught the back of him as he stepped into the car, ducking his head under the doorframe, pulling the flap of the coat in after him. In the moment, she hadn't realized she'd seen all that, but on the walk home, it reassembled for her. So, yes, the refracted man, or Scott Pfeiffer of Grafton, Vermont, had been wearing the same color jeans Brian had left the house in. Same jeans, same coat, same sweater, same color t-shirt. In the apartment, she half-talked herself out of it again. Coincidences did happen in this life. She dried her hair and went into the spare bedroom he often used as his home office. She called his cell. It went directly to voicemail. Made sense. He was either still in the air or had just landed. Made perfect sense. An ash-blonde desk sat before a window that looked out across the river at MIT and Cambridge. They were high enough that on a clear day they could make out Arlington and parts of Medford if they put in the effort. Now, though, behind the sheets of rain, it was an impressionist painting, the buildings retaining their shapes, but stripped of all specificity. Normally, Brian's laptop sat here, but of course he'd taken it on his trip with him. She put her own laptop there and considered her options. She tried his cell a second time. Voicemail. His primary credit cards, an Amex and a Mileage Plus Visa, were business cards. The records were at his offices, which were through the soup and across the river in Cambridge, just on the edge of Harvard Square. The statements on their personal credit cards, however, were easily accessible. She brought the one for the MasterCard up on her screen. She went back 3 months and found nothing out of the ordinary, so she went back 6. All ordinary purchases. What had she been expecting to find? If she did find some irregularity, the inexplicable purchase, the mystery website, would it turn out to be clear evidence he was in Copley Square early this afternoon when he was supposed to be in London? Or would it just turn out to be proof he surfed porn sites, or that her last birthday present hadn't been tucked away a month early as he'd claimed, but had actually been purchased in a mad scramble that morning? She didn't even find that. She went to the British Airways site and checked arrival information on Flight 422, Logan to Heathrow. Delayed departure due to weather. Expected arrival, 8:25 p.m., GMT plus 1. That was 15 minutes from now. She checked their ATM statements and found no large cash withdrawals. With some guilt, she realized the last time he'd used the card had been as a point-of-sale purchase, the necklace he'd bought her at the mall. She looked at her cell, willing it to vibrate, for Brian to show up in the caller ID. Somehow he'd clear this whole thing up. She'd finish the phone call laughing at her own paranoia. Wait. Cell phone records, of course. She didn't have his. His cell phone was provided by his company and therefore a business expense, but she had her own. She spun in the chair once and set to tapping away on the keyboard. In a little over a minute, she had her cell records dating back a year. She called up the iCal and matched dates he'd been out of town against her records. And there they all were, incoming calls from his cell phone when he'd been in Nome, Seattle, Portland. But they didn't tell her anything. He could have made those calls from anywhere. So she scrolled to another week. God, that black, icy week in January. Incoming calls from Brian when he'd been in, or claimed to have been in, Moscow, Belgrade, Minsk. And there, in the fifth column of the bill, were the international long-distance charges she'd accrued for answering those calls. No small charges, either. Why was she getting charged for answering her phone? She needed a new provider, but sizable ones. Ones that correlated with calls made from the other side of the world. As she clicked back over to the British Airways site, her phone vibrated. Brian. "Hey," she said. An elongated hiss followed by two soft pops, and then his voice.
"Hey, babe."
"Hey," she said again.
"I'm...
where are...
what?"
"You."
"I'm in the customs line, and my phone's about to die."
Her relief at hearing his voice was immediately replaced with irritation. "They didn't have an outlet in first class on British Airways?"
"They did, but mine didn't work. You okay?"
"Uh-huh."
"Sure?"
"Why wouldn't I be?"
"I don't know. You just sound tight."
"Must be the connection." He didn't say anything for a bit, and then...
"Okay."
"How's the customs line?"
"Massive. I'm taking a guess, but I'm pretty sure a Swiss Air flight and an Emirates flight arrived the same time as us."
Another bit of dead air. "So," she said, "I met with Melissa today."
"Yeah?"
"And after, I was walking on..." She heard a series of beep clicks.
"Phone's dying, babe. I'm really sorry. Call you from the ho..."
The line went dead. Had it sounded like customs in the background? What did customs sound like? It had been a while since she'd been out of the country. She tried to picture it. She was pretty sure a ding went off when the checkpoint became open, but she couldn't remember if it was a soft ding or a loud one. Either way, she hadn't heard any dings during their conversation, but if the line was long enough and Brian was still at the back of it, maybe he wasn't close enough to the checkpoints for the dings to be heard. What else had she heard? Just a general hubbub, no distinct conversations. Plenty of people didn't talk in lines, particularly after a long flight. They were too tired, too knackered, as Brian sometimes said with a faux British accent. She stared out the window through the rain at the Monet version of the Charles and Cambridge beyond. Not all its shapes were foreign to her. Downriver, she could discern the spiky, amorphous sprawl of the Stata Center, a complex of brightly colored aluminum and titanium buildings that called to mind an implosion. Usually she abhorred modern architecture, but she had an inexplicable fondness for the Stata. Something about its haphazard lunacy seemed inspired. Back upriver, she could identify the dome of the main building at MIT, and farther still, the spire of the Memorial Church at Harvard Yard. She'd had lunch in the yard a few times with Brian. It was just a few blocks from his office, and he'd met her there their first summer together, sometimes with burgers from Charlie's Kitchen or pizza from Pinocchio's. His office was about as unassuming as they came. 6 rooms on the 3rd floor of a nondescript 3-story brick building on Winthrop Street that looked as if it belonged in an old mill town like Brockton or Waltham, far more than in the backyard of one of the most elite universities in the world. A small gold plate outside the main door identified it as Delacroix Timber Limited. She'd been there 3 times, maybe 4, and outside of Brian and his junior partner Caleb, she couldn't name the other employees or recall much about them except that they were young and cute, males and females, with the avid eyes of the ambitious. Interns, mostly, Brian had told her, hoping to prove their mettle and get promoted to a paying position on the mothership in Vancouver. Brian Delacroix's break from his family had always been a personal one, he explained to Rachel, never a professional one. He liked the lumber business. He was good at it. When his uncle, who'd run the U.S. operation from offices on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, dropped dead of a stroke while walking his dog through Central Park one night, Brian, never a source of disappointment to his family, just one of confusion, stepped into the role. After a year, he found Manhattan to be too much. "You can't turn it off," he'd say, and moved the operation to Cambridge. She looked at the clock in the upper right corner of her laptop. 4:02 p.m. There'd still be someone at the office. Caleb, at the very least, who worked like a madman. Rachel could pop over, tell Caleb Brian had left something behind in his office and asked her to retrieve it. Once there, she could hop on his computer or take a peek through the credit card statements in his files, make sure everything added up. Was it a crime to suddenly and wholly mistrust your husband? She wondered this as she tried to hail a cab on